Hello, my name is Ben Burrell and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that takes an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. I know I sound a bit like a broken record because I say this at the start of every single episode, but if you can follow us on Instagram or Twitter, that really helps us out. You can find us at Bob Dylan Podcast. And actually on there at the moment is a photo of Bob's notepad that he was using during the sessions we've covered most recently. Definitely worth 5 minutes for your time. Have a look at Bob Dylan Podcast. My throat is about to give way because I've been doing way too much talking recently, so let's crack on with part number four on a record that perfectly captured the most potent of human desires. This is Blood on the Tracks.
'Twas in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
With this record, Bob did something that even the best musicians and songwriters have found difficult to do, and that is produce a classic, perhaps even his finest work, away from his initial hot streak. Coming almost 10 years after the exhausting quality of Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61 and Blonde on Blonde, Blood on the Track saw Dylan engage in full love poet mode, a state that people like Dylan scholar and literary critic Christopher Ricks argues is his most adored form in places like England, Europe and pretty much everywhere outside the United States. These songs might not have the sweeping grandeur of, say, Blonde on Blonde, the atmosphere of later recordings like Oh Mercy, the fresh blue-eyed verse of Bringing It All Back Home, or the thrilling instrumentation of Desire, but the quality of these songs outshine many other grander productions. The stories and feelings created in these tracks perfectly capture love in all its different guises. Dylan did the almost impossible as he turns emotions into words and music. I mean, you can't physically hear love or rejection or heartache, but we get pretty close on these 10 songs. Novelist Rick Moody called it the truest, most honest account of a love affair from tip to stern ever put down on magnetic tape, and that perfectly sums it up for me. Whilst we can view this as one of Dylan's best ever records, and from a personal point of view, I think taking everything into account, it is his best. How does this match up to some of the greatest albums ever made? When we look at other artists from the 60s, whose work is comparable to Dylan's, I think we see an interesting shift. Whilst Lennon and McCartney were hardly spent forces during the 70s, I think it's fair to say their best post-Beatles efforts with albums like Imagine and Band on the Run don't quite match up to the status of Blood on the Tracks. In fact, the closest we probably get is George Harrison's opus All Things Must Pass, which in itself was partly a homage to Dylan. Elsewhere, the Beach Boys were still trying to recover from the Smile sessions in this decade, and even current artists on a hot streak like Bowie would struggle to match these 10 songs from Dylan pound for pound, and he didn't have the 60s canon Bob did. Obviously, I'm really biased, but I think you'd struggle to find another icon so revered as Dylan knocking it out the park 10 years after his initial breakthrough. And more importantly, with a record that really stood the test of time too. This is something we've seen throughout his career. He appears to be really good at reintroducing himself to his audience after a fallow period, whether it be here with this breakup record, or a decade later with Oh Mercy, or even a decade after that with Time Out of Mind.
I'm walking through the summer nights, the jukebox playing low.
Initially, Blood on the Tracks received mixed reviews from critics. Rolling Stone published two pieces at the time of release, the first by Jonathan Cott, who called it Dylan's magnificent new album. The second reviewer, John Landau, wasn't so sure. He would go on to say the record has been made with typical shoddiness, which has some merit, as at times the recording isn't the best, but as I've mentioned in previous parts of this episode, I actually feel that really adds to the songs. I think the majority of these early mixed reviews were down to Dylan not being particularly in vogue at that moment. I'm sure there was a feeling from those early reviewers that Dylan was no longer considered the best of the best, so they would go with the fashion of the time and play these songs down. This is something we've seen quite a lot in the music press over the years, and it works both ways. For example, when Oasis released their third album, Be Here Now, off the back of two critically acclaimed and mega-selling albums, the new LP was called a classic. However, it's now viewed as a toxic record in their back catalogue, as the quality, in hindsight, falls way short of the first two. The same goes for bands like The Vines and The Libertines, brought up in a rush of being the next big thing. And also the same goes for other parts of Dylan's career too, with records like Planet Waves and its supposed return to form. Blood on the Tracks, though, seems to be doing the opposite and gaining traction with age. It was listed at number 16 in Rolling Stone's Best Album Ever Made poll in 2003, beaten by Highway 61. However, in 2012, it was voted Dylan's best album by his fans in an NME poll, and then in 2013, it became Bob's highest entry at number 36 in another NME poll, this time for Best Album Ever, and this time beating Highway 61. While it might be considered Dylan's best, clearly not everyone shares my view this is one of the, if not the best album ever made. In the public consciousness, I know this record will never top Sgt. Pepper's or Revolver for experimentation, and it will never capture a generation's ear like Nevermind. But for relatability and almost companionship, this record for me wins every time. I've mentioned many times about a loose narrative that runs throughout this record on previous parts of this episode. We start with the relationship coming to an end on Opener Tangled Up in Blue. We then hear our narrator's sadness at that parting on tracks like Simple Twist of Fate and You're a Big Girl Now. So then that split turning sour on Idiot Wind, with our narrator finally moving on in the final two songs. On track 7, Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, though, we briefly depart that into a shaggy dog story.
The festival was over.
The definition of a shaggy dog story is a rambling story that verges on the absurd, and that's just what we get here. It's a self-contained story that moves slightly away from the other album tracks, but is full of the album's themes of love, affairs, and betrayal. It's by far the record's most complex track, and has a full cast of characters to boot. Over the course of the song, we meet the main character, the Jack of Hearts, who has recently come into town as a leader of a gang of bank robbers. We then have the villain of the piece, Big Jim, the wealthiest person in town who owns a diamond mine. He is married to another central character called Rosemary, but is having an affair with a dancer called Lily. The story mainly takes place in a strip bar where all the characters are present for different reasons. At the start, we get a portrait of the town this is all taking place in. It's deserted and dilapidated and void of enjoyment. Bob sings, "The festival was over. The boys were planning for a fall. The cabaret was quiet, except for the drilling in the wall. The curfew had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town." That drilling in the wall line is a major plot point and comes into play later. We then move to be inside the strip bar with its mirrored walls just before the show begins, with the next verse being set backstage amongst the dancers playing cards. Dylan sings, "Backstage the girls were playing five card stud by the stairs. Lily had two queens, she was hoping for a third to match her pair. Outside the streets were filling up, the window was open wide. A gentle breeze was blowing, you could feel it from the inside. Lily called another bet and drew up the Jack of Hearts." This is our first indication of a connection or history between Lily and the Jack of Hearts. She's drawn the card of the same name with an almost wink and a nod to the audience. It's also obviously a metaphor that she's called him there to be with her. Already there's a lot of tension in this song. You can almost feel that something is about to happen, like this is the start of a great Western, which this song is obviously based on. That's continued on to the next verse as Big Jim is introduced. Dylan sings, "Big Jim was no one's fool. He owned the town's only diamond mine. He made his usual entrance looking so dandy and so fine, with his bodyguards and silver cane and every hair in place. He took whatever he wanted to, and he laid it all to waste. But his bodyguards and silver cane were no match for the Jack of Hearts."
Big Jim was no one's fool. He owned the town's only diamond mine. He made his usual entrance looking so dandy and so fine. With his bodyguards and silver cane and every hair in place. He took whatever he wanted to and he laid it all to waste. But his bodyguards and silver cane were no match for the Jack of Hearts.
These five lines give us a lot. We have a great depiction of Big Jim, who sounds like a Bond villain with that silver cane, which is also a sign of wealth. But that last line also reconfirms that our hero is the Jack of Hearts. The lyric of, "They are no match for the Jack of Hearts," sounds like a line from an old Batman cartoon, like he's a superhero, or in this case, an anti-hero. Straight after that, we're introduced to the next character, Rosemary, as Bob sings, "Rosemary combed her hair and took a carriage into town. she slipped in through the side door looking like a queen without a crown. She fluttered her false eyelashes and whispered in his ear, "Sorry, darling, that I'm late," but he didn't seem to hear. He was staring into space over at the Jack of Hearts. It's indicated she is the other half of Big Jim, something that is confirmed later in the song. It's also implied he is less than attentive, as for some reason he's become obsessed with the Jack of Hearts and is still asking himself questions about our hero in the next verse of, "I know I've seen that face before," Big Jim was thinking to himself. Maybe down in Mexico or a picture up on somebody's shelf.
"I know I've seen that face somewhere," Big Jim was thinking to himself.
There's no real concrete indication of why Big Jim would recognise the Jack of Hearts, but given that we find out later they both appear to be having an affair with the same woman, Lily, perhaps he'd seen a photo mentioned in the verse during his time with her. The next verse is dedicated solely to Lily's backstory. It's a classic broken home, lots of affairs dancer's tale, which is preceded by another character being introduced with lyrics of, "The hanging judge came in unnoticed and was being wined and dined. The drilling in the wall kept up, but no one seemed to pay it any mind. It was known all around that Lily had Jim's ring, and nothing would ever come between Lily and the king." Here we're reminded of the drilling in the wall, as well as revealing the fact that Lily and Jim are having an affair, and Jim's powerful nature as he's referred to as the king. But also that sense of foreboding is continued as the hanging judge isn't given a name, just his terrifying title is present. On the next verse, the action starts to take place with lines of, "Rosemary started drinking hard and seeing her reflection in the knife. She was tired of all the attention, tired of playing the role of Big Jim's wife. She'd done a lot of bad things, even once tried suicide, was looking to do one good deed before she died. She was gazing to the future, riding on the Jack of Hearts.
Rosemary started drinking hard and seeing her reflection in the knife. She was tired of the attention, tired of playing the role of Big Jim's wife. She had done a lot of bad things, even once tried suicide. Was looking to do just one good deed before she died. She was gazing to the future, riding on the Jack of Hearts."
In this verse, Rosemary is confirmed as Big Jim's wife, and we hear she's been a long-suffering one too. That last line gives us an idea of her desired conclusion. She is looking to the future, and by the sounds of it, she wants to be with the Jack of Hearts, or at least she wants him to be free. After this, we move to a scene backstage between Lily and the Jack of Hearts after the performance has taken place. She explains it's good to see him alive, giving us the feeling that he's a gangster or a vagabond. It ends with a line of suspense in the form of, "Down the hallway, footsteps were coming for the Jack of Hearts." This is then continued into the next verse with other lines like, "The backstage manager pacing all around his chair. There's something funny going on," he said. "I can just feel it in the air." After this, the story gets a little foggy. We hear the Jack of Hearts is rushing backstage in a costume, meaning he could be darting out to escape Big Jim, although it's unclear as to whether this actually happens or not. What is sure, though, is Big Jim goes to Lily's dressing room to kill him as Dylan sings, "No one knew the circumstance, but they said it happened pretty quick. The door to the dressing room burst open and the cold revolver clicked. And Big Jim was standing there, you couldn't say surprised. Rosemary right beside him, steady in her eyes. She was with Big Jim, but she was leaning to the Jack of Hearts.
No one knew the circumstance, but they say that it happened pretty quick. The door to the dressing room burst open and a cold revolver clicked. Standing there, you couldn't say surprised. Rosemary right beside him, steady in her eyes. She was with Big Jim, but she was leaning to the Jack of Hearts."
Here, Jim fires his revolver, possibly at the Jack of Hearts or Lily. But at the same time, Rosemary, tired after years of neglect, stabs him with a penknife, her one good deed before she dies, as it's stated in a previous verse. Rosemary's actions help everyone to win, and she gets her own back on her husband and also helps Jack, who she has obvious affection for. We find out later Rosemary is hung for the murder of Jim, and the Jack of Hearts is nowhere to be seen. The drilling in the wall lines are clarified as we find out Jack is the leader of a gang robbing the bank next door whilst all this is going on. In verse 13, yes, 13, Bob sings, "The next day was hanging day. The sky was overcast and black. Two doors down, the boys finally made it through the wall and cleaned out the bank safe. It was said they got quite a haul. In the darkness by the riverbed, they waited on the ground for one more member who had business back in town. But they couldn't go no further without the Jack of Hearts. It's left quite ambiguous as to what happens to Jack. Did he run away from it all? Is he dead like most of the others in a big Shakespearean tragedy? We don't know. But the song finishes with a poignant moment from Lily reflecting on it all that's a nice way to wrap it up. This is quite the epic, and it actually turns out to be a nice lead-in to all the stories on the forthcoming album Desire. In fact, this song of vagabonds and exotic locations would have fitted onto that album perfectly. Unsurprisingly, more than once this has been considered as a film, two separate screenplays have been commissioned, but never made. Musically, this is a lot like track 4, Idiot Wind. It benefits from being re-recorded in Minneapolis. Its full band sound gives it a more epic nature than the lo-fi New York strum. Plus, that bouncing country bass line and fast honky-tonk drums set the Western scene perfectly.
But most of all, she was thinking about the Jack of Hearts.
This is a nice mini break in the album's tracklist. While it never sounds out of place, it helps to break up the heavyweight themes with a bit of melodrama and action. From the album's most upbeat track, we then move on to one of the most forlorn moments. If You See Her Say Hello battles with Simple Twist of Fate as the most heartbreaking moment on the entire album, and it might just win with its tear-stained letter lyrics about reaching out to an old friend. Instrumentation-wise, it's a return to that three-pronged guitar sound from You're a Big Girl Now and an organ part that sounds like it's been taken from a fairground but played at half speed, giving it a broken, out-of-kilter feeling that suits the song's tone.
If you see her, say hello. She might be in Tangier.
There's some nice subtle changes on this song compared to the rest of the album. We have a 12-string guitar that's picked throughout by Minneapolis musician Chris Webber. This is accompanied by Bob on the mandolin and another guitar reminding us of that layered sound from You're a Big Girl Now. We also get some tremolo picking on the guitars too in the final instrumental section of the song, something that would appear again on the album Desire. Hear how it creates a nice little sonic moment that you don't find too much elsewhere on this record. Lyrically, this is our narrator continuing to recover from that relationship ending. Here, though, there's a little more self-pity than present before, and he also appears to view himself as a victim. The song is framed as our narrator talks to a third party, possibly a friend of both people involved in the relationship. The lyrics appear to be him passing on a message to his former lover, and they're simple but never less than brilliant. There's some of Dylan's most underrated verses present here. Sure, they don't have the rhythm of Tangled Up in Blue or the life-affirming nature of Shelter from the Storm, but just listen to verse 3's wonderful, dejected lines of, "If you get close to her, kiss her once for me. I always have respected her for doing what she did and getting free." This is again another wonderful distilling of a very precise emotion. This is the stage on their album timeline of the breakup where our narrator is seeing the object of his desire everywhere. He can't escape her or her memory, and his mind is playing tricks on him, again perfectly mirroring real life. Also, for the very final time, there's the slightest hint of possible reconciliation with lines like, "Sundown yellow moon, I replay the past. I know every scene by heart, they all went by so fast. If she's passing back this way, I'm not that hard to find. Tell her she can look me up. If she's got the time."
Sundown, yellow moon, I replay the past. I know every scene by heart, they all went by so fast. If she's passing back this way, I'm not that hard.
Just like with Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, this song benefits from its Minneapolis re-record. The original New York version, unusually, is slightly more upbeat, and because of that, loses some of its resonance.
If you see her say hello, she might be in Tangier. She left here last early spring, is living there, I hear.
Interestingly, on the third verse, the lyric changes from "if you're making love to her" on the bootleg version to "if you get close to her" on the album version, adding to that sense of softening the more autobiographical songs I mentioned in the previous episode when looking at the album's muse. Regardless, by the end of both versions of this song, Anna Rayton knows his relationship is over, but feels he must, for the last time, tell her they can still be together if she wants. Something that finally disappears after lingering around for the better part of side two in the album's last two tracks. At this point in the story, things are pretty desperate. It's an emotional low point of the record, but there would be a happy ending. Something we look at next time.
She still lives inside of me. We've never been apart.
That's it for part number four on Blood on the Tracks. The penultimate episode is done. I don't quite know what I'm going to do when this finishes because my life has revolved around Blood on the Tracks over the last 4 or 5 weeks. My wife's not been too impressed with that, but I've had a good time nonetheless. I hope you've enjoyed them too, and thanks for listening. And also, thanks for your messages on Twitter and Instagram over the last couple of weeks. We've had quite a few, and they've been really nice, and they're more than appreciated. Thank you for them. As I said at the start, if you can follow us, that'd be great, at Bob Dylan Podcast on either of those. And we have a website too with some blog posts that might interest you, all about Bob. You can find that, bobdylanpodcast.com. Thank you once again for listening, and until next time, goodbye.